With us on the phone to talk about civil commitment laws and their limits is Mark McCary. Welcome,
Hey,
Mark.
nice to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for the last minute notice here. But you wrote a piece in the November issue of Z Magazine, and recently there was another piece in Counterpunch by Alex Coburn on the same topic, basically. Why do you think the kind of left media is now more receptive to this topic?
Well, these civil commitment laws that you mention are a terrible abridgment of civil liberties. What they've done is they've done an end run around the Constitution, and letting states that want to civilly commit people lock them up, after they've already served a prison sentence, lock them up for life, and until that the person who's locked up can prove that they're no longer going to be dangerous. They've started it for sexual offenses. So these are people who have committed sex crimes, anything from a violent sex crime such as rape to consensual sex between a teenage boy of 19 and an underage girl of perhaps 16 or 17. They're putting them all together in the same category and saying that if they've done this crime, even though they may have gone to prison and served a sentence for it, if a committee of police and prison officials decide that this person should stay in for a longer amount of time, they can keep them in. And that's if I, that completely eliminates double jeopardy, being tried twice for the same crime. It eliminates something called ex post facto, which is another civil guarantee under our Constitution for many years that prohibited people from being punished for a law that was not in existence at the time they committed the crime. Several things like that. The main thing is due process. It also overrides, the notion of a fair trial. And like, if you do something, then, you are going to get punished for it, and that's one thing, but that's a clear-cut thing that that's all it's going to be. And the state cannot just arbitrarily come along later and lock you up, whenever they want to. And these new civil commitment laws, unfortunately, let the states do that now.
You're listening to Subversity. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. But why do you think the editors of these publications are open now to like dissenting views on this topic?
I think the left is beginning to look at the cost, the civil liberty cost for these laws, and the fact that it's not just the truly violent, small group of people out there who really should be locked up for a long time or for life, but that these can apply to you and me and everybody else out there. And the problem is the way these laws are written and the way the courts, including the Supreme Court, has interpreted them, is that if anybody is seen by the state, by a state, as maladjusted and potentially dangerous, they can be locked up for life. It used to be in the old days, if you had to be a danger to yourself or somebody else, you had to have a mental illness, as defined in something the American Psychiatric Association has, a manual called the DSM. You had to have a competent medical authority certify that you were a danger for this reason, as listed in this manual of accepted mental illnesses.
And
Well, that's all gone by the boards.
homosexuality used to be on that manual list.
Yes, and eventually it got changed. There was a reform process for that. The problem is now there is no reform process. There is no process. There is no due process, no process at all. A committee of police and prison officials who, are looking at somebody who is in prison about to finish their sentence can say, hey, this person is dangerous. We think he's dangerous. We don't have to prove it. We don't have to say he or she, and there are some women who are subject to this too, has a mental illness. They can just, lock him up. And that's a, that's a heck of a violation of all of our liberties because it means they can do that for anybody.
So is this worse than three strikes?
I wouldn't say it's worse or better than three strikes. They're all bad in their own ways. But what this thing does is fundamentally subvert the Constitution by eliminating due process ex post facto and the other civil liberty guarantees that have been bedrock protections that we have as people, as part of the compact of a democratic civil society, is that, the government will do certain things and there will be certain prohibitions of things it can't do according to our Constitution. And these have been built up in, as courts have created protections and have, been as interpreting the Constitution and as laws have been passed, these have been built up over the last couple hundred years, and it's all been sort of swept away now. The Supreme Court just held a ruling in January saying that, affirming once again that states, have this power now to civilly commit people. And what's happening is that then the people who this is subject to, they're in a catch-22 situation because they have to prove somehow that, you know, they're no longer going to be a threat to society. Some of these people, you know, again, to my mind, a clearly small group are dangerous, and they should be, you know, they should have very long prison sentences to begin with. But you shouldn't go in after the fact and say that, you know, well, shoot, we couldn't put this person away for life. Then, you know, therefore we're now, you know, do it through the back door by doing it this way.
So these people have actually served their sentences?
These are people who have served sentences for a crime they've committed. And again, this can be anything from a, you know, what would have been 20 years ago, a rap on the knuckles, you know, of, you know, some slightly older young person and a slightly younger young person having sex, to a, you know, serious sex crime. And what has happened is these laws got passed in the mid-90s, starting, actually 1990 was the first one in Washington, but the bulk of these came into being in the mid-90s. In various states, because of what each state, there was some sort of sex crime that had happened, some really, truly egregious crime, like the little girl who was just killed in Southern California, something of that order of magnitude. And these are fairly rare crimes, as horrible as they are. They are fairly rare, but, you know, people looked at that and they said, you know, in our willingness to never, ever let this happen again, you know, we're going to pass this such a law. And the problem with that is that the laws then take away the civil liberties for everybody else, and they really actually don't help, you know, help you at all. They don't stop, you know, the people who are truly sick and violent, dangerous people. They don't stop them. The only way to do that is through something like a three strikes.
You know, the part of the reason for these laws, I suppose, is the concern that that sex offenders are not curable and that they will reoffend.
Well, that's ironic because the data that seems to be out there, and this is federal government data, there's an agency called the Center for Sex Offender Management and CSOM.org, and the data on there shows that the recidivism rate for people who commit sex crimes is typically a lot lower than the people who commit, you know, other sorts of crimes, be it violent or nonviolent.
It's like 19%, right, at most?
Well, it depends. The data is variable because the treatment is very variable, and there's no solid number, but, you know, but it's certainly, there's certainly a relative difference between these two. And in addition to that, they show that if the treatment is voluntary, the recidivism rate, you know, the committing a new crime again, is a lot lower. If the treatment is forced, involuntary treatment, like these laws specify, then no, then it doesn't have much effect, because somebody who is coerced into it, it's sort of like somebody who is an alcoholic or has some other mental illness from that sense, that they have to want to change, and they have to buy into the fact that, you know, what they did was wrong, and their attitude was wrong, and they have to change, and they have to want that, and that has to come from within. And so the state, in my view, should be offering help to these people. They should be offering programs to them, for sure, but they shouldn't be saying, you know, you're going to be sent away for life until you can prove that you've changed.
Do you see the spillover effect of these laws on, like, currently in this campaign against war against terrorism?
Well, the problem is that the due process has been eliminated with these laws. So you've seen an analogy with the people, you know, who have been arrested and held, you know, without adequate access to counsel, without, you know, due process, without many of the rights that, you know, we normally enjoy, because they are, in many cases, allegedly non-citizens. And so, you know, and particularly you're seeing this in the Guantanamo situation, where the Bush administration or regime, take your pick, is calling it these people as detainees. And in reality, they're prisoners and should be subjected to, you know, the due process rights that prisoners enjoy. So there is an analogy that way. But, I mean, obviously, the, you know, the two situations are quite different.
In terms of back to sex crimes, in California there's this reporting requirement that if you are convicted of a list of, like, litany of lots of crimes, you know, if you commit one of them, have to
And in fact, many homosexuals, many adult male homosexuals who had committed a crime in the 50s, 1950s or 60s of publicly soliciting. At that point, it was a crime for one man to approach another man in public and say, you know, gee, you look good, you know, would you like to have sex with me? That was a crime. Many men were arrested and for that, and whether they were convicted or not, even though they had been arrested, then they had to serve, a sentence as for that. So sorry.
Yeah.
So
they were
as a result
as
of that, they then had to register when these registration laws got passed.
Right.
And that was a terrible thing. That did get undone. The California State Legislature did amend the state registration law, I don't know, a few years after it was passed to do that. But, but for a while, for a time, they were forced to register. And if they don't register, that's an automatic jail sentence.
Yeah, I know I read that some even people were in the 50s, they got letters saying, on the top of the envelope saying you have to register.
Mm-hmm,
it was
mm-hmm.
on the front of the envelope
mm-hmm,
as a sex offender.
Mm-hmm, yeah, let the neighbors know.
That's the
kind of thing that happens. Yeah, the register's an argument now that the current registration requirements is a detriment to the, it's an incentive for people who should be registering themselves to hide and not register because they have to go through the process. Their names are probably going to be put on the internet or otherwise disseminated to at least the people who live nearby.
Yeah.
And there have been many, many instances now of people who have been harassed, who have been physically attacked, who have been burned out of their homes, and even in a few instances killed because of this. The police have not, done any sort of job to try and protect these people. So, the argument is, you've done the crime, you've done the time, you hopefully are rehabilitated, you're trying to live a law-abiding life, and then you have to go through this. It's the same thing with these civil commitment laws, and the proper name for them is the sex predator laws. They're called predator laws for a reason, because they consider these people to be so far beyond the pale of, human decency that they're animals, in a sense, and therefore they can be stripped of all of these constitutional rights that, we take for granted. In reality, when you do that, to one citizen, then you're doing it to another citizen and to every citizen as well, and that's a terrible thing. But for these sex predator laws, that's exactly what's, been going on. And, they're serving as a disincentive for people who need help to get help and, who should be, otherwise living a law-abiding life to live a law-abiding life. Some of these sex predator laws, what they do is if the person is already out, they've served their crime, they're on parole or they've even finished parole, and they've got a job and a family and they've got a stable life again, they're still subject to them. They can still be picked up by the police and put away indefinitely just on the whim of some bureaucratic committee that decides, let's do it.
So how is there's no attempt now at rehabilitating sex offenders, right? It's basically throwing away the key.
Well, it's waste management is the word that one legal journal article used. John Simon, in a legal article, called it the waste management. And but it's very high priced waste management. The price tags for these things is 4 to 5 times the cost for running a jail. And I'll give you an example. The first state that had such a law, Washington State, they've spent averaging about $50 million a year for a facility that has just a few dozen individuals, one woman and the rest men, to run them. They have a lawsuit that they have spent more than $100 million taxpayer money defending the lawsuit because the Supreme Court, when it upheld these laws, it was skating on very thin ice by taking away all these constitutional protections. And so the way it upheld the laws was it said that these states have to do certain things. And so the people who are in, who have legal support, and some of them do, have lawyers, are filing all kinds of lawsuits. There's a plethora of lawsuits against these treatment facilities that say that, they're not providing constitutionally adequate, quote-unquote, treatment. Well, each of those lawsuits is, costs a fair amount of money to defend. And so, like I said, Washington State has spent more than $100 million, defending just these suits. And that's on top of the cost of running the facility. It's very expensive.
Is the treatment also based on kind of bogus science?
Well, it's based on really no science at all. The people who are running the treatment facilities, there's an association called the American Treatment Association of Treatment Professionals for Sexual Abusers, and various government entities that have looked at this admit that there's no accepted criteria for running these centers. And what has happened is, as states have implemented them, they've put low-level psychiatric technicians in, from their mental hospitals in as kind of custodians. These people don't get direction, they don't get trained, they're unsure as to whether they should be guards or whether they should be counselors. The people who are in there see that, their situation is hopeless. They're supposed to get treatment of some kind to to better themselves and to show the world that they've changed and are no longer a danger, and yet the state is not giving them treatment, and that's why all these lawsuits are happening. The abuses that go on, for example, at Atascadero State Hospital, which is one of the oldest mental institutions in the country and is a huge place, is an ultra-high security place, and they do things like flooding a person with ammonia fumes to make them vomit and to feel that they're drowning, as they watch images of, other individuals to whom they are sexually attracted, to try and get them to not feel this way. I mean, these are crude techniques that date back to the 50s, to the Ken Kesey era of, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's the same kind of stuff. It's, still going on.
Aversive therapy.
The therapy is, that...
Aversive therapy.
Aversive therapy is the name for it. And, and then they give them drugs, unapproved drugs. There's a drug called Lupron. The only approved use by the FDA is for women who have endometriosis, which is a very painful, debilitating disease, and the drug does some help there, but its side effects are so great that the women who have taken it have formed a Lupron Victims Network. And there's a victim, LupronVictimsNetwork.org out there because of this drug, and yet this drug is the one at Atascadero and the other treatment facilities are using because there is some evidence it suppresses sex fantasies. Not a lot of evidence, a few reports, but that's enough for them to give this dangerous drug, on an involuntary basis to people that are in there. So again, the treatment is something out of the 50s, and there were these scandals back then of Willowbrook Mental Hospital in New York. Geraldo Rivera got his start exposing their practices. There were the Kesey novel, Once Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There was a movement to deinstitutionalize people, to say, hey, this is inhumane, this is not working. And what happened was they did that, and now these places are back. These institutions have never gone away. They've shrunk, but now they figured out with these new laws, these new civil commitment laws, here's the way, and they're back, and they're flush with cash because of all these people that the states are now locking up.
Why do you think the Supreme Court ruled in support of these?
Well, because again, the heinous nature of these crimes. The person who was committed, who was the landmark case that the Supreme Court ruled on, Leroy Hendricks. This was back in 1997, a case called Kansas versus Hendricks, and this was the seminal case that upheld these laws. And after which there was a tidal wave as other states. Once this case was upheld, other states went to implement the laws. Everybody said that this man was a very dangerous individual who was very violent and, had done all kinds of bad things. Turned out he wasn't violent at all. He did have a statement he did make to the during a cross-examination where, they asked him if he would, how could he be sure he would ever, never again molest a little boy because that's what he had done. And he said, well, I can't, how could I prove it? I can't prove it. I can't prove it unless I'm dead. And the media then took that statement as, Hendricks defiantly saying he would never stop molesting until he was dead. And that got on the front pages of papers, and so the Supreme Court put that in their opinion. They said, this is what the man said, therefore, he's a very dangerous individual. We need to keep him confined forever, and, we can abridge these constitutional rights to do it.
There were, in the 50s or earlier, there were sexual psychopath laws that they use against homosexuals.
The irony is that these sex laws have come and gone, and every time they've come, there's been at great cost and at abridgment of civil liberties, and then they've gone. They've just been scrapped. And the so-called sexual psychopath laws that you just mentioned have been scrapped. States that had them have undone them. Almost every state that had a sexual psychopath law, and these were passed in the 40s, or have undid them in the 60s. And before that, there was another wave in the 20s of laws. They were called defective delinquent laws. They were passed to great fanfare, again, because of a few heinous crimes that had happened, and they were all undone.
So it's a moral panic kind of thing.
It's a moral panic. There's a book by that title by Philip Jenkins well worth taking a look at, and he documents these two waves. This third wave came with Anita Bryant in Florida, who had launched a campaign to strip gay people of their civil rights. There was an anti-discrimination amendment passed for the Dade County that protected gay people in employment and housing, and she led a successful campaign to undo it. And the way she led her campaign was that homosexuals are predators and they're a threat to children. And so that's been the albatross, one albatross anyway, around the necks of the gay movement. And, the gays have just, distanced themselves from that. Hey, we don't, of course.
That happened here in Irvine. The Irvine voters repealed the gay rights ordinance because of this guy, Scott Piotta, who's actually running for controller, I think, in next week's election.
Yeah, they always are like that. I mean, you know, I was
back under another permutation.
Yeah, I was the author of an anti-discrimination amendment for gay people in Yellow Springs, Ohio, when I was at Antioch College, and that successfully passed the town council against the, you know, vituperation by a fundamentalist Christian who came and opposed it. And the way it passed was not because of anything I wrote. It's because, you know, there were real people in this little village, a very liberal village in southwest Ohio.
College town.
A college town. People who had been discriminated against, they could show they were discriminated against. And so the town council said, okay, you know, we're not going to allow discrimination. You know, as far as I know, Yellow Springs has kept its anti-discrimination ordinances. I think more than 100 cities have them now, and even a few states. But Anita Bryant was the one who, you know, first showed the world it was possible to undo them. She put sex with children center stage in North America.
Right.
And ever since then, there's been this preoccupation that's just increasingly grown. In the 80s, there were the daycare scandals of McMartin and Fells Acre in Massachusetts. You know, horrible allegations, crazy allegations that were all unfounded. You know, you had the McMartin kids on the witness stand identifying city council members as being among the perpetrators. I mean, it was just a laughingstock, you know, and you know, except after ruining people's lives and costing taxpayers, again, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Now
so all that got, you know, all this resulted in these laws, and these civil commitment laws are one example of it.
There's also right now going on in Boston and other Catholic dioceses, right? The whole kind of hysteria over Catholic priests, and they're digging back into the past. Even people that have retired or not actually,
yes, they are.
You know, committed any,
yes,
been charged or convicted of any crime, they're being pilloried through the press.
Yes, that's very true. And you know, that unfortunate thing with it. I mean, part of it is, you know, again, this is my own personal opinion. Is, you know, it's the churches covering up this sort of stuff and,
right,
you know, transferring priests instead of really dealing with it, which they should have done. And so people are very rightly, to my mind, just, you know, justified in, you know, holding the church responsible. On the other hand, then there is this witch hunt, you know, thing that comes about, and you do have this. And when you have a witch hunt, then what happens is the people who, you know, need to be helped are driven underground, and they're harder to get at, and they don't want to change, and it just makes it, you know, that much, you know, the situation just gets worse. I mean, you're not solving the problem. Philip Jenkins, in that book, Moral Panic, he points out that these laws, all of these laws, not just the civil commitment ones, you know, they not only take away civil liberties, but they don't solve the problem. They make the problem worse because they ignore the problem and they cause the people who are responsible not to try and change. So it's really, you know, completely the opposite effect.
On next week's election, there's a judge trying to get reelected, and he was his house was raided, and he was put in under house arrest. He's actually under house arrest right now for some sex charges, and so some of my friends are actually going to vote for him as a protest against these sex laws. They think that it's a way of to speak out against this reporting statute and also this civil commitment stuff. Because if he was convicted, he would, this judge who's over 50, I think, will probably have to register for life, and if he's convicted. And apparently a hacker went into his computer and found some pictures.
Well, then that's a whole other can of worms, because the so-called child porn statutes, when the Supreme Court just held their January ruling in the predator, the sex predator laws, the civil commitment laws, they also held a hearing on the child porn law. And they are still haven't decided that. It's been 4 months.
Right, right.
And my guess is the justices are very deeply divided over a law that clearly, to my mind, is unconstitutional. But, you know, they don't want to be seen as sanctioning images of children who may be sexual. I mean, that would be certainly a bad thing. So,
well, the Lobby Association has been, the Librarians Association has been at the forefront of opposing restrictions in libraries on access filters and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, as far as I know from working in the computer industry, those filters don't work very well. You know, they don't filter, but they do filter out stuff that, you know, young people may want to have access to, such as birth control information.
They might filter your article out.
Well, that's fine. The URL is zmag.org.
And you can click on the November table contents and for that magazine, ZMag, and you will find Mark McHarry's article on sex predator laws. There's also an article in, what was that, Counterpunch, that Alex Coburn also wrote about the same topic. And also, she mentions a magazine called the Guide Mag, Guide Magazine in Boston, which has also covered this, guidemag.org. org, I think.
Com. Yes, Adinsa.com.
GuideMac.com. Mm-hmm. So there's resources, and if you go to the Subversity website later today, we'll put up a list of links to other resources on this very controversial topic.
Well, I'm grateful you're covering this, Dan.
Yeah, did you get any negative reaction to your article?
I imagine maybe some people will send letters to the editor at some point, but no, so far no. In fact, the people who have seen it seem generally fairly impressed with it. And I'm trying to disseminate it as widely as I can.
How about mainstream? Has mainstream media picked up on this?
True mainstream media seems to be interested only in spurts. The New York Times has been covering it because of a local story that's very dramatic, and they're using that as an example to illustrate the laws with,
and they're doing
a good job.
What local story? What do you mean?
There was a boy called Sam Menzies who murdered another boy, and it turned out that the boy Sam Menzies was involved with an older man. And so the older man is now serving time as a sex predator. And the New York Times has been covering that as a human interest thing from his standpoint, the boy, also the constitutional issues involved in these sorts of laws.
So are you optimistic that there'll be kind of
I think these particular laws are going to falter under their own weight. They're going to collapse under their own weight because of their tremendous costs, not because of civil liberty concerns, and certainly not because of sympathy, but purely costs. They're too expensive for states to implement. They just can't do it from a constitutionally adequate point of view. And it seems to me they're giving up on it.
How about cops themselves? They don't want your neighbors kind of running you out of town. If they want to know where you live, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
if
you have to register as a sex offender.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, cops don't want, violence either. So, yeah, sure. But in terms of the predator laws themselves, I think they're going to die. And I think the Supreme Court decision in January was a big step in that direction because it made it a lot more difficult for states to commit somebody as a predator now.
It made it more difficult?
Yes, it did. It put a standard for a thing called volitional impairment. In other words, the states are going to have to prove that the person who was being committed was volitionally impaired. In other words, that they literally couldn't help themselves.
I see.
And that's going to be hard for them to do.
So even though they upheld it, they made it harder?
Yes, they upheld it, but they made it harder. Yeah, because it's a cost issue for states. I mean, states could imprison these people for life the first time and just be done with it.
Right.
And that's probably what they're going to do. And for some people who are not going to in for life, they're going to give them a lifetime parole, in effect, very strict parole, which is a heck of a lot cheaper than locking somebody up for life. So in terms of the people who are affected directly, they're still going to be behind bars forever. But in terms of general civil liberties, at least it seems that as a society we're beginning to back away from that approach now.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Coming up to the end of our time. Thank you very much. Bye. That was Mark Meharry, author of an article in Z Magazine about sex offender commitment laws. Tomorrow at Los Angeles, there will be at 12:30, there will be a forum on Palestine with Ramsey Clark, Michelle Shihadeh, and a bunch of other speakers. And it's at Holman United Methodist Church, 3320 West Adams at 12:30. Next week, we expect to play the rest of the speech that was given by Edward Said at Chapman University here on Subversity. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity.
Aspira Foster and Family Services is a statewide nonprofit organization devoted to